Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 11th of June, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock on a very rainy day. It's a rainy Thursday, but we are here, we are together, and just wait, when this panel gets going, the rays of sunshine that will be emanating from your radio will be unbelievable. We welcome you all. Thank you very much for being with us. It is a great pleasure to be in your company, as always. Let me introduce the group, and before I do that, a reminder that you can be part of that group by simply emailing us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Speaking of a ray of sunshine, WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hooray!
You're a ray of sunshine.
Hooray!
How did the media project go? How did that taping go?
It's always good. You know, there is this question as to whether the New York Times should have published the Tom Cotton interview. I polled the panel. I think everybody believes that you can't not publish something like that. Although, you know, there were those people who felt they should be factual, that the paper had a responsibility to publish another article next to it. I don't know. I mean, I think we on WAMC have always given the other side and have always had people like Herb London while he was alive, and now somebody from the London Institute, and our wonderful friend Rich. You know, I think it's terribly important.
Well, we'll talk probably a little bit about those issues. Judy, were you on this week?
I was not on this week. We briefly touched upon the Cotton editorial last week, but it's really developed since then with the resignation of Jim Bennett, the top guy in the editorial department at the New York Times. So it remains a really fascinating story, and I don't think it's over yet.
Well, what do you think, though? I mean, you know, no fooling around here. What do you think?
Now, let me just say, Judy Patrick is the vice president for editorial development of the New York Press Association. We value her input here. Yes, Judy?
Yes, well, as I said last week, I thought that an opposite view doesn't mean it has to be published. There are certain things you don't publish because they're just wrong. You wouldn't publish a defense of rape there are certain things. In this editorial, part of the problem was the way it was written, and there were some inflammatory language and some things that were just wrong. So the defense that it didn't meet the editorial standards, I think, is a good one. That being said, I do think that you do need to publish some explanation of why people would think that it would be okay to use military force on civilians protesting, exercising their First Amendment right to freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. So if there's some reason out there, some rational explanation for it, I think it would be valuable to publish. That being said, the Cotton one was fundamentally flawed.
All right, good stuff, and you can hear the Media Project this weekend and, of course, on Monday afternoon as well, anytime on WAMC.org. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics Vera Akarios-Kelly joins us. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. I'm glad to be able to contribute.
Well, we're always honored that you are here and contributing, and it's a great pleasure to speak with you, as it is with Skidmore College President Philip Glotzbach, who joins us this morning. Good morning, Philip. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine today, I think.
Well, we'll...
Day ain't over yet.
Well, we'll take care of that. Now, you're still president for what, 2 more weeks?
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah.
A couple weeks here.
Yeah.
Closing in on the final date.
You get screwed out of a party, or do you get a party?
Well, that's the least important thing going on. There's going to be a virtual event coming up here in a couple of weeks. They will do something very nice, so I'm looking forward to that.
All right.
All I can tell you is I don't like it when you're on, and I'm going to tell you why. Every time you're on, I'm married to a skiddy, and every time you're on, there is mention of sending you some money, and so I'm going to the poorhouse because you're on the program.
Well, Alan, it's a good way to do it. I think, you know, it's a noble cause. So thank you to Roselle. I appreciate that.
Yes, a noble cause, and certainly in Philip's honor as the great year. How many years of service to the Skidmore community?
It will be 17.
Oh, that's great. That's a good
17
number.
Years. In president's years, that's about 120.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a good run. That's a good like, long run.
That's like dog years, right? Yeah.
Good for you.
Like dog years, exactly. That's
well, congratulations.
But Alan, every time I come on, I remind myself I should send some money to WAMC, so I think we're even here.
Oh, it evens out. That's good. And you'll still
somehow that money doesn't go in my bank account.
No, I know. Well, it doesn't go in my bank account either, so let's be clear about
that. That's all true. And you will, and you'll still do the show even though you're not president anymore, right?
If I'm invited.
Oh, you'll be invited. You're invited. Please, you're all invited. All right, let's go to the issues of the day and start our conversation of what is going on. You know, I'm going to start with, there's a lot of different places that we can start, but I want to go with the virus story because, man, I just don't get it. And maybe as a group, we can groupthink this and figure out what's going on here. But basically, what we're seeing is coronavirus cases rising nationwide. Public experts are urging caution. The numbers in many states are going through the roof. And meanwhile, many states, as well as the federal government, are just saying, yeah, you know, okay. There are disturbing data points for the ongoing tug of war between federal, state, and local officials weighing the economic cost of restrictions meant to stop the spread of the virus with the human cost of lifting them. Texas, Arkansas, South Carolina, Nevada, Arizona, North Carolina, Oregon, Florida, and Utah all set new highs in 7-day rolling case averages on Wednesday, according to the Washington Post. Montana, Arkansas, Utah, Arizona, and Texas have all seen coronavirus hospitalizations rise by at least 35% just since Memorial Day. Some states pressing forward with reopening, even as local officials point to data that suggests an increase, not a reduction, in the risk of transmission. The uptick may not directly correlate to reopenings in all states, as many robust testing or other localized factors could play a part. Meanwhile, you have the administration saying that it's business as usual. It has been 1 month since there was any briefing given by the task force on the coronavirus. Nobody really seems to know what the status of that task force is. And also eerily quiet is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And on top of this, you have, with all of these numbers and with all of these concerns, you have the President of the United States saying that he is going to start his rallies up again without social distancing, without masks, in what initially anyway as usual, meaning no, he has said that he doesn't want there to be spacing because he doesn't want it to be perceived that there is a lapse in the crowd or anything like that. The first expected to be next Friday in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So a lot going on when it comes to the virus. Yes, when you look at the country as a whole, the Northeast has suffered greatly, obviously, and we are not seeing the numbers that we did, which is good news in the sense that we are on the other side of the mountain. But when you look at the other parts of the country, it is gravely concerning. Alan, let me begin with you of how this got, you know, it seems like this got away from us, and I just don't understand why this is even. I can understand the president's motivation. I cannot understand the motivation in other states where they are going ahead knowing that there are some really big issues.
This president is a degenerate. There's no other way of looking at it. He's a degenerate. I mean, the idea that he says, well, it's more important that people don't think that there are lapses in my audience than the fact that these people are putting themselves at grave risk. And that's disgusting. So, you know, everything that this guy does can be measured in terms of his chances of being reelected. Virtually every decision he makes can come back to that. And, you know, you're right to raise that point, Joe, because it is really so disrespectful of the American health situation.
Well, and also the just the language that he is using, Judy, is troubling to me, of saying that the virus is, we're just seeing the embers, we're seeing the ashes of this pandemic. There are health officials, very respected, well-respected health officials in this country, who say if this were a baseball game, we're in maybe the bottom of the second inning.
Right, and language really does matter, because people pay attention to what he says. Aren't you glad that you live in New York State, though? It's one of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately. This is a real mess. And while I live in New York State, a lot of my friends and relatives live in some of these other states that are in real danger. But if you pay attention, there are countries around the world that are doing this, or they're taking the same approach, that getting the economy started is more important than saving these lives. We're going to, you know, we're going to take it on the chin and lose a few people. Meanwhile, there was a Harvard professor talking that we will be up to 200,000 lives lost by September at some point. Just think of that. Those are people that will die. In some respects, all the people who go to Trump's rallies, there's a danger that they're going to infect it, and he may lose voters that way. As sad as it is to say, I mean, maybe that's the strategy we should use with him. Maybe he'll come to reality that we tell him that his supporters may actually die, and he may lose votes that way.
You know, it's also the modeling that you cited just a moment ago, of showing, yes, we could be up to 200,000 deaths by September, which really isn't that far away, but that is the low end of that spectrum, and there are some that say it could be 400,000. The 200,000 is based on if we do everything, quote-unquote, right, which we don't seem to be doing. Vera.
Yeah, I'll admit.
Yeah, go ahead, Judy.
I'm thinking, well, maybe I will go to a yard sale this weekend. We all have to be careful. We have to really understand this is a very serious virus, and it's killing people.
Vera.
So I wanted to comment on two things. Of course, I agree with everything both Judy and Alan said, but in general, I think there is something that I would diagnose as magical thinking among the population in this country, which is, let's ignore scientific evidence because we really feel like we want to be outside and enjoy our lives again. And secondly, as part of that magical thinking is to be anti-science and listen to misleading messages from local officials in some of the states that you mentioned, such as Texas, Arkansas, I think North Carolina was on the list.
Yes.
There are various areas where people have decided enough is enough. I just want to enjoy myself again. And somehow they're convinced that nicer weather will and time outside will prevent further infections. In addition to that, some state officials are actually misleading the population by saying, oh, we're now so much better prepared because we have PPE stashed away. We have emergency rooms ready to take you in. And in fact, we know in places like Arizona, they're filling up the emergency rooms and
intensive care is, I think,
80%. Intensive care units to very high levels. And I think they said in the next couple of weeks, they'll be over full. And then they have increasing death rates, of course. Now, I call that misleading the public and magical thinking among the population. So that combination of not learning from what happened here on the East Coast is shocking indeed. And I think we will pay dearly for that in the coming months.
You know, I think that's another point, is that the people who are opening up are saying, well, look, you know, the virus is steady in 9 states. It's down in 21 states. Yes, it is. But those states took a tremendous hit. And they also resulted in the deaths of you know, 130,000, 140,000 people. Philip, we just have about a minute, but I'm interested in your thoughts before we go to break.
Well, I do think there are concerns in the, you know, the numbers will reassert themselves. This, the one thing about this pandemic that we've all seen is that people can ignore science, or they can misrepresent the facts or whatever, but eventually the facts catch up to them. So we will see what happens, and it is a concern. Paul Krugman had a pretty interesting piece a couple of days ago about America failing the marshmallow test, you know, the,
right,
the famous research that doesn't necessarily hold up, but the metaphor is a good one, that, you know, you can either eat your marshmallow now or you can wait 15 minutes and eat two of them. I think Governor Cuomo is saying it the right way, that it's not a dichotomy between staying completely closed or, you know, throwing the gates open, that we need to be smart about this and do it in stages. And the thing that he has said that I certainly agree with is that when you go to reopening, you do it in phases and you watch what's happening. You look at the numbers and keep open the option of going back to a more closed situation if the numbers spike. It seems to me that's a formula for doing it. We can't stay completely locked down forever. And going from closed to 100% open or even 80% or something makes no sense. So if we could be more disciplined about it, I think that would be the solution. But we are definitely seeing a spike in cases out west, as people have said, and down in the south and some of these other places. So we'll have to see what happens.
We're going to take a break, and we welcome your thoughts on this matter. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Philip Klotzbach will continue our discussion after this news break.
Should have never been said, if I got what's coming. Man, I should be dead, but bam, bang, boom.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We got a great panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Philip Glotzbach. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. I mentioned in the rundown of things going on in regards to the virus that the president is expected to return to his rallies next week. And he is expected to have a rally in Tulsa. We have a letter from Richard who says, it has to be noted that the buffoon occupying the White House will have his Tulsa rally on the anniversary of the Tulsa massacre. Talk about insensitivity. It also should be noted, I think, I'm deviating now from Richard's letter, which is a really good one, but also it's Juneteenth. And this is not, obviously, this is not a coincidence, but you take this moment, this situation, and you say, okay, not only, so there's the one aspect that we've been talking about in the first part of the program of the health ramifications of putting however many thousands of people into an arena or into a tight space, but on top of that, just the insensitivity of giving, given what's going on in the world. And I guess, Alan, to him, obviously, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think the only thing that matters to this president is, of course, getting reelected, and he'll do anything in his power, including, I suspect, some things that aren't very pretty, Joe. Mostly making sure that Democrats, including blacks and browns, don't get to vote. And that is truly reprehensible.
Let us, we get this letter from Rich, who says, masks may be an important key to keep pandemic under control. Why are people following Trump's anti-mask attitude? Well, because they don't believe it, right, Vera?
Well, also, I think, if I may say that, I've encountered some people say, I know the masks help, but they're so uncomfortable, or I feel kind of hot underneath them, or my glasses fog up. So, you know, there are all these sort of discomfort issues related to it. And of course, there are a variety of masks one could try and experiment with. And this idea that we in the United States, or also in Europe, we're unmasked societies, as in the sense that we are not used to that. Whereas in many countries in Asia, masks have been used for a longer period of time, and people are used to that and do it. And I think we just need to go through that as well. We have to become a bit more masked.
You know Vice President Mike Pence last night on social media posted a photo of himself giving a thumbs up to a very crowded office of Trump-Pence campaign workers. There were probably, I would say, 100 people in the photo, all tight together, and not one of them had a mask on. That tweet has since been deleted, but it was a stark presentation of the fact that they just don't care about masks.
And also it was in violation of the, I believe that was in Virginia, which is in violation of their rule of a mass gathering as well. Alan?
Yeah, you know, you turn the television on, and what do you see? You see everybody selling products for how you look, whether they're people putting stuff on their legs or people putting stuff on their faces or people. And now you say to Americans, okay, we expect you to wear a mask in order to save your life. And it's antithetical to everything that has been laid on us by popular culture.
Well, and I direct this to anyone on the panel, but especially to Judy and Alan. But I mean, we all remember what it was like in the early 80s when Governor Cuomo, Governor Mario Cuomo, passed the seatbelt law. Oh, my God. You thought people were going to just you're taking away my rights.
Absolutely. My dress will be wrinkled.
Right. I mean, and, you know, sometimes, and same thing with smoking. Well, we got two comments about Alan's use of the word degenerate. Let me read both of them. And Carl says, so are the protesters who showed up in large groups recklessly risking everyone's health also degenerates? I don't quite get that. But also, we got this from Anna and said, using ordinary words for Trump, instead of calling him degenerate, how about calling him selfish? No misunderstanding or ignorance of that word, understood by all age groups. Well, I think you can use both, right? We're not limited to one.
I'm sticking with degenerate.
We also go to Richard. No, I read that one. I'm sorry. That was about the. Philip, do you have any thoughts about we're talking about the health effects and talking about masks, of course, but the idea of going to Tulsa, going to this on the day, the anniversary of the Tulsa massacre, also on Juneteenth. I mean, that, and given the moment that we are living in now, as people continue, for the 16th night last night, people were on the streets for Black Lives Matter, and we continue to just see more and more disturbing police video that is being released, and to have such an event at such a time, it's certainly not a coincidence, is it?
Well, I mean, we are certainly dealing with a national tragedy that's been a national tragedy for hundreds of years, and it's becoming more evident to a broader swath of the population, particularly the white part of the population. So that's something that's happening right now, and I think many people are trying to understand the history and how it has played out, particularly for people of color, for Black people, for that population and individuals in that population. And it is a moment when all of us need to be sensitive, not just to the reality, but to the symbolism. And, you know, is this decision to hold the rally on the anniversary of the bombing, which was an anti-government terrorist, domestic terrorist attack, is it an accident or not? Who knows? But it wouldn't be surprising if they somehow did pick it. There was some very disturbing news footage that I saw yesterday of some white protesters who were, you know, holding an American flag and standing in front of a Trump sign and all that, sort of reenacting the death of George Floyd in a gleeful way as protesters went by. I mean, that's a horrible example of how people are somehow celebrating this tragic event. It would be better, certainly, if the president were not doing it. If he were
No, go ahead.
No, I'm done. I mean, I don't want to. My only thing I was going to say is I don't want to conflate, you know, the terrorist bombing in Oklahoma City with the police violence that we've been seeing. I mean, they're not the same thing, but I do think there's a deep underlying relationship. And the anti-government part of the rhetoric, that certainly has been part of the Trump administration. It's been part of Mr. Trump's rhetoric in his campaign and subsequently, even as he heads the government. That is a very dangerous kind of rhetoric. And many people have commented that in the time of crisis, this COVID crisis, we really have looked to the government. We've had to look to the government for guidance, for support. Think of the legislation that's been enacted to try to provide a safety net for people whose lives have been economically disrupted by this pandemic. You know, so we're kind of forced to look at that, look to the government. And yet this anti-government rhetoric persists. So that's an unfortunate part of our public consciousness with some segments of our country. Okay, I'll stop.
Vera.
So I wanted to comment on Juneteenth, right? What is really interesting about this date is that it has been chosen as the date to celebrate African-American liberation,
right?
This is a very important moment to mark for African-American and diverse communities. It is a liberation a moment, right? A moment to mark as the freedom for a significant portion of society. Now, the fact that Trump is holding a rally also on that date sends a message not only of intolerance, but of pure rejection of a holiday, a systemic, you know, it's a systemic rejection, deep rejection of a moment in history that is celebrated by only some, and the vast majority of the population in this country have never even heard of this day, don't know what it's about. They reject it because it's not really recognized as a national holiday. So it's one of those moments, one of those signs that shows how deeply ingrained racist ideology is in this society. So it is not only being intolerant by the Trump administration, it sends a very clear signal to his supporters that white people are supreme and black people are to be ignored, to be rejected. Their moments of historical memory don't matter to the majority of this country, is what he's saying. And I think as white members of society, we also are called upon to change that. And I think it is a moment, Juneteenth, we should all celebrate and recognize our African-American, Latino, and immigrant brothers and sisters in this society who are experiencing a lot of rejection, not only open direct violence, but this sort of underlying messaging that is constantly understood as you matter less. Your memory in history is not important. So this is very carefully chosen, I believe, this date by the Trump administration. And it sends an overarching message of complete rejection of anything that relates to African-American or minority moments in history.
What I was going to say is, and at the same time he's doing that and offering that insult, the other insult is that he has no intention of changing the names of those military bases, from Confederate-type people to something that is more representative of what we're thinking. And again, it's a trope, and again, it goes to the trolls and to the people who support him. I have no doubt that that's what it's about.
The other thing, Alan, to that is that you yesterday the president said no one has done more for African Americans and people of color than he said no one has done more for them than me and my administration. You also have the president, the Attorney General Bill Barr, and also Larry Kudlow. Not sure why he's weighing in, but he did.
And he was told to, that's why.
And said that there is no such thing as systemic racism, which is, you know, is really, it is a bit mind-boggling, isn't it, Judy?
Oh, it seemed like it was a message that was sent out to them all to say on the Sunday talk shows this past Sunday, sure, to deny that the idea. Even Ben Carson is saying that there's no systemic racism when it's clearly a fact that it is. The sky is blue. The sun comes up every morning. One thing I wanted to say about the Tulsa event, I'm concerned that the news media is going to make the same mistake they made in 2016 and start carrying these things live. And that would be a mistake. They have to be very careful about how they cover this campaign because back in 2016, they let him run. And all his in his factual errors, all his dog whistles, all that was left unchecked. And so I think we have to watch out and make sure that doesn't happen. So it's up to the cable companies. They can do what they want. But my advice is be very careful about carrying these things live.
And as long as you mention the cable companies, comes the news. I think we may have mentioned it already, that CNN is being sued by the president for putting out a poll.
Yes.
Let me jump in quickly. May I? 1 second.
Of course.
I want to come back to Vera's point about Juneteenth, which I think is really worth thinking about. One of the traditional elements of Juneteenth celebrations has really been around education, remembering, telling histories of community and all that. And one thing that we can do, I mean, we as people who care about this, who care about trying to make this society better, who actually do believe there is such a thing as systemic racism that needs to be fought and overcome, is do what we can do to make June 19th an educational moment. So it's something else. There could be counter-programming. There could be commentary. I agree with the point that we need to be judicious in our coverage of the president's rallies. We don't need to broadcast them live.
One,
look at June 19th as an opportunity to celebrate the history of the African-American community in this country and to talk about things, about important topics.
One quick clarification, because we have a number of letters on this. The actual Tulsa massacre took place on June 2nd, so it is not the actual anniversary. However, in Tulsa, it is being honored throughout the month of June. And of course, because of Juneteenth, the two were going to be honored on the same day. So just to clarify that and save a couple of letters. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more. We have more letters and we'll go into other issues as well. We have Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Philip Glotzbach on the panel this morning. We'll include your letters too. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Go to some letters before the top of the hour and our news break with Ray Graff. Denise says, don't think for a minute that Stephen Miller isn't fully aware of the significance of Juneteenth. Look no further for the cancer in Trump's administration. Paula says, wear the mask. Think a mask is uncomfortable? Try a breathing tube or a ventilator.
Good point.
Bobby says, I have some friends who are in New York, educated, affluent, who like to think of themselves as enlightened. I heard one say, when thinking of getting on a plane to visit grandchildren in a western state, not California, well, how long can you go without seeing your family? We are so spoiled, we white, financially comfortable people. How long can you wait? How long did people have to wait to see a family during a war? How long did they have to wait when flying was out of reach financially? How long to ensure that they and others do not get sick? This is so disturbing. It's not only Trumpers. People can justify anything to themselves when they want to do what they want to do. And that was a point you made, Vera.
Yes, magical thinking, I call it.
John says, with respect, I think it's time that you stop referring to us as blacks and browns. Check your vocabulary. We also have Trump has said several times, what do you have to lose? He loves throwing the dice. Vera is spot on. Religion encourages the practice of suspending science over faith. Remember Galileo. Richard says, I already read that one. I apologize. Roger, it is, who says, what makes you so sure that Trump won't surprise you with a Juneteenth acknowledgement? Well, I'm sure he will acknowledge it, right? But not in a meaningful way. Anyone disagree with that?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe, I mean, you know, he
deeply inauthentic for sure if he does mention it.
Also, Fran says, should news reporters attend these rallies at possible detriment to their health? Judy Patrick, what do you think?
Oh, sure. I mean, do you remember in 2016, they were booed, they were bullied, they were caged, they were put in little cages. I mean, well, reporters often are put in a designated area. But yeah, I don't. This has been a tough season for reporters. There's a press freedom tracker that tracks, you know, the amount of assaults on journalists, and typically they do 100 in a year. These protests alone, the last I checked, it was up over 250 incidents of assaults on reporters. But the rallies have always been a tough place for reporters to be. The crowd is naturally hostile to the press because the president repeatedly tells them that the press is the enemy of the people, when in fact the press is the best friend the people really have.
And to the point of the letter, too, is that you're doing this during a pandemic as well, which I guess you could ask the same thing of whether it be the rally that is taking place with the president or the protests that are taking place across the country of the reporters being put in harm's way, which is part of their job, right?
Right. You can't. I mean, a lot of reporters are doing their jobs by phone, but there are some stories you have to be out there, especially photographers have to be out there meeting people face to face and covering protests. You have to be out there meeting people face to face. You have to take some protections, but it does put them all at risk. And it's something I think news producers and editors are very aware of. But it's part of the job. It has to be done. I mean, covering a war is far more dangerous, but this has its own inherent dangers as well.
Joseph writes to us and says, demilitarize, de-escalate, reform, lawless law and order, Trumpista authoritarians and their trolls chortle with glee at the prospects of Dems trying to defend/explain/defund. Alan, what do you make of that? There's a lot of going back and forth over that word. I know we talked to Governor Patrick about it yesterday, and you talked to Governor Cuomo about it earlier in the week.
And Joe Biden just checked in on
it.
Yeah, come on. Defund, you take a word for what it means. Defund means take their money away. Defund means if they have money that is coming in, you take it away. It's ridiculous. Obviously, we need police, but we need better police. We need police who are in great need, police departments, of reform. And how do we know that? Because chiefs of police everywhere are telling us that. Who becomes a policeman? And that is very important. The character of the people who want to be a policeman, and why do they want to get into it? You know, reform is the right word. Defund is not.
Well, also, can I say, I think part of reducing budgets and reducing funding for police departments is the whole issue of this militarized police that we have. If we just reflect on the man, the 75-year-old activist in Buffalo, it seems that whenever police have their, you know, shoulder pads on and their protective gear, they sort of feel often in encounters with people they consider annoying or pesky, there are members of the police force who simply behave like, football player bullies and push people out of the way. It is often the excessive use of violence that is linked to militarized gear that sort of seems to empower certain types of individuals. And I think that needs to be looked at, and budgets need to reflect a reduction of this militarized equipment, and civil oversight boards need to be empowered and have some real influence on disciplinary action and management of police departments.
You know, that's such an interesting point, because in New York State, for example, New York City, there's always been a constant fight over civilian complaint review boards. Every time it's raised, the police unions get crazy. They say we can't afford this. And then it turns out that they don't have the powers that they really ought to have. So you make a good point. You make a very good point.
Philip, you were going to say?
I was just going to say, as a former long-ago football player, I resist the, the juxtaposition of football player and bully in the same sentence. But I think Vera's point is well taken. If you put on a certain uniform, it can make you feel a certain way. And I do think when you gear up with combat gear, it does affect your mentality. And so the demilitarization of the police would be a good thing. There are times when they need that gear, and let's just be clear about that. But they certainly don't need it as often as they probably use it. The whole question to me is, what is the basic conceptual structure of policing? And, you know, we're seeing a debate here. I mean, is it a top-down application of force? We need to suppress the bad things that are happening and, you know, all that follows from that. Or is it a more community-based, look, we need to be part of the community. We need to be invited in. We need to have relationships with the members of the community. Camden, New Jersey is a poster child for this. And 7 years ago, they totally redid their police force. And the numbers, again, have been astonishing in drops in crime and everything. So there are ways to do this. Camden is a smaller city, not on the scale at all of Minneapolis or New York. But community-based policing has been shown to be successful. So the question is, how do you implement that? And do you really need to to close down a police department and start over? Or are there ways of hitting reset and changing that attitude among the members of the police to reflect a more community-based? I think there's so many policemen and women across the country who want to do that and who are doing it. But there are clearly a lot of police folks who are not. So the question is how you get it.
We're up against a break, but go ahead, Alan.
The big story here are the unions and the fact that the unions in all of this protest have lost the essential political power that they've had all along. You're going to see some real changes.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Vera Akarias-Kelly, and Philip Glotzbach all on the program this morning. We'll continue our conversation. First news with Ray Graff.
I'm no longer that guy. I can't start over again. You know my friends, they all tell.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. And just so you know, the music that we're listening to this morning is from Dion. It's from his new album, Blues with Friends. And, you know, I hate saying this, and I apologize in advance, but we've been playing so many people lately who have passed away. Dion is alive. I just want you to know that. Please do not be worried. Dion is alive. The playlist is posted online, WAMC.org/roundtable, WAMC.org. Okay, so Alan brought this up, and I want to go back to these pair of stories here. One being that the president has rejected renaming military bases named after Confederate generals. He responded to waves of demonstrations for racial justice on Wednesday by picking a fight over the legacy of the Confederacy, further inflaming the nation's culture war at a time when tensions are already high after the killing of George Floyd and widespread street protests against police brutality. On the same day that Mr. Floyd's brother pleaded with Congress to tackle racism in the United States, Mr. Trump publicly slapped down the Pentagon for considering renaming Army bases named after Confederate officers who fought against the Union during the Civil War. The White House said the president would go so far as to refuse to sign the annual defense authorization bill if Congress tried to force his hand. Meanwhile, in protests last night, assuming that they were in response to the president's action, there was several monuments and statues that were taken down by protesters themselves. Some very peacefully and even with the protection of the police around them. Also, in other news, there is this, culturally speaking, is fairly significant, and that is that NASCAR has announced that at their events, which I should note, they will, for the first time, I think this weekend, will be welcoming fans to the stands. So we'll see how that goes as well. But NASCAR says it will ban Confederate flags. And the this comes after one of the drivers, I think the only driver, only black driver, it was Darrell Wallace, who was the first black driver in 50 years, called on NASCAR to ban the flags. And then so they do this. And I will admit to you, I'm sorry. I will admit to you, my first thing was, oh, they're allowed? Really? I didn't. I mean, I know I saw them, but I didn't know that they were actively like selling them and allowing them. So it's like reading, you know, a news story of, oh, look, murder is now illegal in Mississippi. But there we are. So go ahead, Alan.
And Joe, somewhat ancillary, but probably not exactly, is the fact that General, I think his name is Milley, is that how it's pronounced, Milley or Milley, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has now publicly apologized for appearing with the president in front of St. John's Church,
yes.
In Washington, and has now publicly apologized for being there, saying it was an inappropriate mixture of military and politics. That's amazing.
It really is.
So, and on that note, I'd like to say the military brass is increasingly realizing that the public anger that has swelled up against police violence is now also deeply affecting the National Guard, which was called out in D.C., and they are worried that the public will lose confidence in the military if they are not beginning to address some of those symbolic names and messages that are being sent by having slaveholding Confederate leaders that are after which bases are named. So I wanted to mention the fact that the rank and file is it has a high percentage of people of color, right? And the brass is beginning to understand that the grassroots within the military will also be deeply affected in a more immediate way in these messages by the Trump administration, and they're worried about divisions within their military ranks. So you know, it is very interesting to see the messaging from the top that they're sending to the Trump administration, or at least creating some separation between themselves and Trump.
Alan?
Well, you know, I don't know what their motivation is, but I know one thing. And that is, they fully understand, all of the Joint Chiefs, the former Joint Chiefs, all fully understand that you can't have the military being used this way. I like to think, you may be right, Vera, but I like to think it's not as specific as you would say that they're worried about their own people and the rest of it. I think it's much more likely that they think that the Constitution is basically being violated. And that they're there.
Well, they're coming a little late to the game, don't they? But at least they're showing up now.
Well, you know, let me just say that the military has been in an interesting position on this, actually, for quite a few years. Back in the 90s, they filed amicus curiae briefs in some of the celebrated affirmative action cases in support of affirmative action. You know, the military has a checkered history on racism, as all our institutions do, but they were one of the earliest institutions in this country that really tried to abolish discrimination based on race, after the 50s and 60s. So they're, at least they've tried. And the fact that they're speaking out more publicly now, the generals, is really an encouraging sign. I mean, I'd like to actually disagree with Joe on the NASCAR point. I mean, you know, for whatever reason, the fact that we are seeing NASCAR and the, you know, Goodell of the National Football League and so on, and so many corporate CEOs speaking out on this, all put, take it all together, I think that those statements by people who were either silent in the past or were on the other side of this debate is a very encouraging sign that this might be a moment of genuine potential for widespread change.
Oh,
moments are moments.
Well, I agree. I certainly didn't want to make light of the moment. My point was, I just can't believe that they didn't do it 20 years ago.
Well, we can say that about anything, and I certainly agree with that. But I mean, NASCAR has been a bastion of a certain kind of symbolism, and you know, it attracts. I would suspect many of its patrons supported the president in his election, and so on. You know, and the fact that NASCAR would take this stand is really pretty incredible. So, I just think that we're at a moment of potential cultural change, and if we can continue to support the momentum behind this, I mean, everything from the police departments to just the realization that institutions have to change, it could be a remarkable moment, not just in terms of potential legislation and so on, but public consciousness.
So on that note, I also wanted to make one quick comment, which is, if we take the argument out of the United States that we sometimes hear some people articulate and say, well, flags are symbols of history, statues, you know, Confederate symbols and the names of military bases, that's all part of history. You can't just take history away. That's part of reality. Take that argument outside of the United States and how about thinking along the way of, well, should we have statues of Hitler in Germany to remember the history? This is not an appropriate argument. Memorial museums? Yes, we can have statues like that to talk about what the significance is and how society has evolved. We can have historical books. We can have discussions and presentations, but these kinds of symbols do not belong in public squares where there is no context to explain why these are controversial and often despicable human beings that should no longer be displayed without any critical context in a public location. We should have memorials, we should have museums, we should have educational opportunities. But there is this is really an important moment to shift that into a public discussion that involves actual experts on what happened in history and not simply revere these kinds of figures without knowing the horrendous crimes they have committed.
Judy Patrick.
Well, here in upstate New York, you don't have to drive far to see a Confederate flag flying on from somebody's pickup truck or on the front of their house. I think for many of these people, they just don't get it. They don't understand. They, I've never known a racist to admit they're a racist, but I think people with the Confederate flag don't, they think of as old Dixie. They don't, they're not, many people it's never been explained to them how offensive it is and what it symbolizes to so many people. And I think that this is a real opportunity to explain that. Sure, we live in a free country and people can fly the Confederate flag. That's their right if they want to. But in terms of being in public squares, NASCAR is a public entity. They have the right to say, no, we're not going to have that in our arena. But again, I think a lot of people, especially a lot of people just don't understand what all the fuss is about. And I think we need to do a better job of explaining to them what the problems are.
So to further this issue, you have a letter that comes from Ellen who says, if you're tying your desire to rename military bases named after historic slaveholders, you must also include Washington, Jefferson, and not just Confederates. How do you answer that?
Well, I mean, historically, we should put revered leaders like that in the appropriate context and not simply say, weren't they great men? And then stop right there. No, we need to understand what the historical moment was and how these people may have been brilliant people, but also had a deeply repressive and destructive side. Why do we have to idealize people in one way and not be open to any criticism or understanding what actually was happening in the country? Why gloss over the pain and the difficulty. Why are we not capable in this country of reflecting and thinking about the complexity of historical figures?
Alan?
I just wanted to report that, and I think this is very interesting, that CNN, I caught it out of the corner of my eye, is reporting now that the Republican Majority Committee, appropriate committee in the Senate, is basically calling Trump out. And what they're doing is they are saying we have to take down the Confederate, we have to change those Confederate names. Now Trump said that, you know, I know this because I was listening earlier this morning to NPR. Trump says he won't permit that to happen from the Congress. So maybe, this is the first time we'll see some guts, or what may be guts, coming out of the Republicans in the United States Senate who feel that they are really up against it now.
These apparently weren't really great generals.
I'm sorry. First, Judy, go ahead, and then Philip.
Yeah, go ahead.
These Confederate generals, apparently weren't even really good generals for the Confederacy. They were big losers. So it's not like they're being honored for their military expertise. I don't know whether or not they owned slaves. They were mounting a rebellion against the country, but they weren't even good military guys, is my point.
I would point out that they lost the war.
Well, they won a lot of battles in the war. That's also true.
They did. And
they
a lot of people.
The war
and
in
a lot
large
of good.
Part.
Yeah, a lot of good people died.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Phil.
A lot of people died. It's huge. The North won the war because in the end we found some great generals like Grant, and because we had overwhelming industrial and population capacity compared to the South. But there's not to defend the Southern generals. And I think that is a difference between Washington and Jefferson and the South. I mean, the South did enter into a state of rebellion. I have no argument from me on any of that. And I agree that the parallel with the Nazis in Germany is exactly apt. It's often been said that the South lost the war, but they won the peace. And they really did win the symbolic battle of, creating this image of the heroic South that was celebrated in all kinds of ways. And it really did celebrate racism. So no argument on any of that. But back to my point that there are just so many signs right now that this is a potential turning point moment in history. We've had these kind of moments in the past. We've had legislation like the 64 Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act and so on. But we saw a huge backlash to those pieces of legislation that played out for years and years politically here. If this can be a moment of changed consciousness with a solid majority in this country, it is possible that we could move forward from here in a way that we've not been able to in the past. So it's going to be pretty interesting to look back in a year and 2 years and 5 years and see if this is true. It may be true, it may not be true.
You know, when I do my morning 4 mile walk, I listen to my Pandora station, which I put together, and with some regularity, Dixie shows up. And I always say, what the hell is that?
Well, someone was mentioning this earlier on the panel that there, Judy, I think it was you, that there becomes a disconnect, right? That people don't even. I certainly think I'm not saying that a lot of people don't know the history and aren't doing it consciously, but I do think in some cases there's a disconnect from the cultural and the historical, and meaning if you program that into the radio station, then nobody even thinks of it as something that is racist.
Right.
But it takes people to call it out, obviously.
Like me.
Exactly. Let's go to Stephen, who says, beyond the economics of Roger Goodell's mea culpa on protests against police brutality, his gesture would seem more genuine if he and team owners offered an apology and a contract offer to Colin Kaepernick.
I couldn't agree more, because these kinds of messages suddenly come out after there's widespread criticism from African-American NFL players I'm just thinking Goodell quickly sat down after he realized if he doesn't speak out and if he doesn't apologize and redirect the NFL, what about people of color no longer playing for a year in the league? And wouldn't that be a devastating financial loss? So I'll take it for what it is. I think they finally realized this could be a major problem. And they're, of course, coming late, but better late than never at all. So I'll take it for now. We'll see where it all goes. But Kaepernick better get some contract in the NFL or some role to play for the future.
Yeah, well, TikTok, before he turns 50, it would be a nice thing to do.
Yeah.
New York's Delaware County Fair has refused to prohibit the selling of Confederate flags at the fair, says Diana. There has been a concerted effort in the past 2 years to get the fair to ban them, but they have only said they can't be openly displayed, and some vendors have ignored that. Let's see what happens when the fair returns.
Exactly. I bet there's going to be some changes made.
And I know we've seen that in Judy at our fair in Washington County Fair. That was an issue a few years ago as well.
It was indeed. And actually, I don't remember how it turned out.
I think they said no, and the fair said that they were not allowed to sell them, and yet many vendors did. They found them when people went.
But then we as customers also have a role to play. Do we spend our money at stands like that? Do we actually choose to purchase from vendors like that? I think it's time to take an economic stand and say enough is enough.
Phyllis in Shandaken writes, perhaps having that rally on Juneteenth will backfire at a time when many a white person who never heard of it is made aware of its existence. Let's have protests that day. We should note there are many, many protests planned that day. Paul says, am I missing something? It appears to me that Trump is doing everything he can to lose re-election, ignoring the needs of all but his base, which is limited to about 39%, as shocking as that is in and of itself. Without a third-party candidate to siphon off votes from Biden, one would think that Trump would at least feign an attempt to woo new voters beyond his base. His doubling down on his 2016 campaign strategy during today's times is sure to lead to a 60-40 loss. Who is advising this monster? Again, what am I missing?
I gotta say that from the very beginning, I've had exactly the same question. I don't get it. You play to your base,
I get it.
And you let me finish. So what happens is he plays to his base. He expects that his base will turn out, and that they will turn out in the key electoral states where he won the last time, and that that's how he's going to win again. And he says, "I did it the last time. I'm going to do it the same way." This time, I predicted, and you will all remember this, I predicted there's going to be a blowout in this election and that Biden is going to be overwhelmingly elected and Trump is going to be rejected. But I could be wrong.
Yeah. Well, as we keep saying, it's a lot of time between now and then.
It is.
And I mean, I agree with what Ellen said, but I think Trump is actually so convinced that he has a gut feeling or an understanding that is not based on reality, of course, but in his bubble, he calls together a panel of African Americans to say to the American public, look, people of color or African Americans are in a better position than they have ever been under my leadership. And then he has, you know, 5 or 10 people speaking to this issue. And for him, that's convincing. And he actually believes, because he trusts his gut more than numbers and science and whatever else it is, he actually believes that African Americans, in part, are going to vote for him.
We have just a minute before we have to take a break. We'll go to two letters, one from Thomas, who says, a little late. They certainly had a chance to speak up during the impeachment, but they didn't. They had their chance to get rid of him, but they didn't. The Republicans have sold their soul in the interest of power. The Republicans need to get woke about how disastrous this president is to America and our Constitution, and they need to be vocal about it, but they probably won't.
Good letter. And here's the thing. I love that Americans need to get woke. I think that's right. And one of the things that is, and the Republicans need to, is that you know these guys can't stand this man. You know that they go home and that they put their heads down on the pillow and they weep. But they can't because they are so motivated by personal power that they keep on doing it. So what this represents is not too late, but that the wheel has now turned.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back and continue our conversation for its last round right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Last call for the group, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Let me go to the letters that we have here, and that will, and we'll get to some more. We start with Sean, who says, "You are all against Trump and Pence not adhering to mask norms, rightly so, but I've yet to hear you mention hundreds, maybe thousands of protesters not wearing masks. Typical WAMC double standard, question mark? I think so."
I don't, and I got to tell you, we've talked about it a lot.
We sure have.
I know I've talked to the governor about it a lot, and he's not happy either about it. And he's, in fact, insisted that because people are not adhering to that norm, that they all get tested. And he said, we'll make it available and it won't cost you anything because he's aware of it. We're all aware of it.
Lucy writes, "I completely agree that many Americans seem to be incapable of self-discipline in the name of their health and that of others. It should be noted, though, according to the New York Times, that a lot of older people are attempting and committing suicide because of their isolation. Seeing grandchildren and other loved ones is really the lifeblood for many." Bruno says, "In my country, France, they take down street names after slave traders and replace them with similar." All right, there's words missing in this. I'm sorry, I didn't pre-read it. I apologize. I don't know what they're trying to say. Anna says, "Defunding the police is about taking money away from police and putting it toward the community in a preventative way. Police are often reactionary, and investing in community support is more proactive. Police do so many things that I think there is definitely a discussion to be had about breaking up what police are responsible for in creating slash diverting those responsibilities to more specialized groups."
Anybody? And that is absolutely accurate. I mean, why don't we have more money spent on, projects related to drug treatment and counseling and mental health related issues? Why do we just simply rely on calling the police and then we have horrible incidents of repression, use of violence, guns in the mix? I mean, we can do so much better if we just separate out what expert social service groups can deal with versus what the police really has to address.
We had a letter earlier about the making the distinction, talking about it's a slippery slope if you talk about the Confederate generals, then also talking about the fact that Washington and Jefferson and other founding fathers were slaveholders. We have a couple letters on that. Mark says, "Neither Washington or Jefferson took up arms against the United States. Confederate generals were traitors. For that reason alone, they should not be honored by the U.S. military." Also, Allen writes, "Confederate generals were in open insurrection against the United States. The founders, at least, were not traitors. It broke my heart to learn that Fort Benning, where I did my basic training, was named for a traitor and a particularly poor fighting general."
There you go. I think our listeners provide even more excellent ammunition for name changes there.
Russ says, I've always found it disturbing to drive through both Pennsylvania and New York, the two states that shed the most blood fighting against the Confederacy, and see Confederate battle flags flying. That flag is not even the Confederate flag. It was a flag around which Confederate soldiers rallied in their fight to maintain slavery. One thing about military bases named after Confederates, as opposed to something like Washington, is that Washington never fought in an insurrection against the United States. That is a significant difference, as pointed out by some of our other letter writers. We got this from a listener who says, communities get the policing they can afford, not the policing they deserve. With unemployment in minority communities exceeding 30%, I wouldn't expect a lot of bells and whistles in their police funding, and community liaison measures cost money. Anything on that, Judy?
You know, over the decades that I covered local police forces, I saw things change, especially they get money from the state and the federal government as well. And oftentimes that money is tied to the acquisition of more militarized, cars or equipment. I've seen that this whole war on drugs seem to accelerate that a little bit. Maybe not so much the state, but the federal aid. If you remember after 9/11, there was all this money that was sent out to the local communities, and you saw the local police forces buy these armored police cars or things that they just did not need if they were just going to do community policing. And it has been a remarkable transition over the last 40 years.
You know, Philip, I was interested. I was thinking of this coming in. I meant to ask you earlier, but I'll do it now. With so much discussion over the years, and rightfully so, about town and gown, of how a college fits into a community, can you give us a sense of fitting in with the police department and the of what that relationship is like between a college, university, and its local police?
Well, that's a great question, and I the answer in part is it's going to be a particular answer depending on the college and the police and the city and so on. At Saratoga Springs, we have had a good relationship with the police, although the police have had something of a checkered history along with other police forces, and there have been racial incidents that I could tell you about that are not happy ones. At the more official level, we've had a good working relationship with the police department in part because the folks who have headed up our campus safety operation have had good relationships with the police. And that's been important to us. We know that if there were an active shooter, or there have been a couple of cases when fugitives have been in the area, or, you know, we've needed to call for, you know, even if just a student gets lost in the woods on our campus, which are pretty extensive in a winter's day, we've had an immediate police response to come and help with those situations, and we've appreciated it very much. So we have had a strong relationship with the police. We are considering offering some resources at this moment in time, and we haven't moved on this. And of course, I'm moving on, but my successor may well want to take this up. Offer some resources to local police departments to see if there's something we can do to, you know, provide some workshops or training or partner with them in going forward to address some of these issues. So I think that could be a very positive discussion. We've tried to maintain good relationships with the city and with the police, and I think largely we've succeeded. But again, that's not to say that there haven't been issues with the police department, and we would love to be part of the solution to help move forward to move past those.
And in the meantime, not at Skidmore, obviously, but at the State University campuses and other places, the police, the on-campus police, have always been lobbying for the right to carry guns. And in some cases, I believe they've gotten it, although I can't tell you that I know that for a fact. But when everybody goes back to school, I have a feeling there may be some residuals about what's going on here on that very issue.
Well, so I wanted to say, in terms of Siena College, very similar to what Phil just described in terms of the Skidmore community and administration relationship with the police. We, as well, at Siena College, have a good relationship with the Colony Police. However, you have to also remember, at the same time, we have minority students and people of color among our faculty, and they have not always had such a good experience because they get stopped for what is generally called DWB, which is driving while black, and have been stopped for no reason, asked or suspected to have done something. There are searches of cars. I mean, these are questions that have to be revisited on all college campuses. What is our official relationship as an institution with local police, and what are the experiences of all our community members? And that is the conversation that I think we will bring to college campuses in a more intensive way in the coming weeks and months as school restarts.
Philip, you got cut off there. Go ahead.
Absolutely. No, I absolutely agree. And that is the dichotomy. And it's the people, the police officers on the ground who do these things more frequently than, I mean, there should be zero tolerance for this. And it does happen, continues to happen. So absolutely right. I wanted to come back to Alan's point. We've not had any agitation to have our police force, our campus safety force sworn to carry firearms, and that's not something that's going to happen. We also have had to work with that, make sure that we don't have the kind of incidents that have been reported from other colleges and universities nationally, you know, where a person of color is accosted in a college room, a college space, and ask, why are you here, when, you know, the person's a student. We need to maintain constant vigilance about that. We have done diversity training with our campus safety force, and we're pleased with that, and that's an ongoing thing as well. So I think, like every other organization in this society, colleges and universities need to be incredibly vigilant, incredibly proactive, to look to their own house and make sure that we're doing everything we can do, to look to our own campus safety operations. And I certainly agree with Vera that we have a role, and there's more that we can do in the future to work with local law enforcement to really help help those organizations improve in the ways that we're talking about now in this national conversation.
We are out of time. I want to thank everybody who joined us this morning and for all the letters. We didn't get to a lot of them. Well, we got to most of them. I shouldn't say that. We only left a couple on the table. My thanks to Alan Chartok. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Big Joe.
Also, thanks to Judy Patrick, Vera Carius-Kelly, and Philip Glotzbach. We will continue our conversation and have the Congressional Corner next on the Roundtable.